So we had been talking about what was Jesus' master plan to reach the world. We talked about a little bit about what his mission was, what his goals were. We talked about his, I guess you'd call it simplistic approach or his simplistic method to reach those, reach the world. And we had spent a little time doing that. And then since I got to teach on Sunday night, we took a little breather and went into talking about parables. So we won't get into that as much today. But we had talked about his selection, how he had chosen very few men to help carry this out, those who were capable of teaching. And then we talked about his association with the with those 12, how he was always with them, how he devoted his time to them. We talked about consecration. We talked about his demonstration, how he would demonstrate the things that he would want them to do. So he went out and he was a good example for them. We were just getting to the point where we were going to talk a little bit about delegation. How he was at the point where he was going to put them to work. So they had gotten to see what he would do. They got to follow him around. And then, like any good leader, he was going to delegate tasks to them. So in Matthew chapter 10, and we're going to not read all of this, but if you want to turn with me in Matthew chapter 10, we see where the 12 are sent out. It starts there in the first part of that chapter. It says, "And when he had called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease." Now the names of the 12 apostles, and it tells them, and then it says, and then I'm going to skip down and read 5 through 7. "These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, 'Do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" So he sends them out. This is what I would say is the start of his delegation, charging them with going out and preaching, telling people that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. If you just go, and this would be a great chapter to read, but we're not going to read it all just for sake of time. But if you skim through, there's some verses that I definitely want to hit. You know, there in verse 16 it says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." And then go down to verse 22. It says, "And you will be hated by all of my... You will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end will be saved." Verse 28, "And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." So here we've got him, you know, charging them with what they're going to go out and do. He's giving them fair warning, though. It's going to be tough. There's going to be people that are going to hate you, but they're only hating you because for me, my name's sake. And you know, be prepared. Go out as sheep. Be wise, but make sure that you are harmless as doves. So I think this is a good chapter with him delegating, charging them to go out and do the work, but what they should be prepared for. If we go over to Mark, we can read similar account there. But in Mark chapter 6. He tells them in, 7 through 13, "And as he called the 12 to him, he began to send them out two by two, gave them power over unclean spirits. He commanded them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bag, no bread, no copper, and their money belts." Again, we're talking about this very simplistic approach. Think about what their task was going to be to do. Don't take these things, just go out. He tells them to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. "Also," he said to them, "in whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for the city." So they went out and preached that people should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. So here we have a little bit more insight to how they were going to go out. He was sending them out two at a time, paired up. And then we can go into Luke chapter 9. Luke 9 and verses 23 through 26 tells, he said to them, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what advantage is it to a man if he gains the whole world and is himself destroyed or lost? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his own glory and his Father's and of the holy angels." And I'm just reading a few verses there just to kind of talk about this preparation, him sending them out, him delegating now, you know, what they've been able to watch him do. So he's assisting them in saying, hey, here's what you should be prepared to do. Here is your mission. So I'll stop there on delegation. Does anybody have any thoughts or additional comments about some of those things we just read? Quite the charge and quite the task. But were they going to go it alone? And the answer is no. And we know that he was there for them. So my next point is supervision. You know, as with any good leader, one might delegate tasks, delegate certain things to be done. But then there's good follow-up or there's good supervision. And he was no different. He kept check on them. He used their experiences to further instruct them. So as they would run into certain things or have certain things happen to them, he would follow up. Let's go back to Mark. I had turned back to Matthew, but let's go back to Mark. And let's go back in that sixth chapter there to demonstrate this point about supervision. I think there's plenty of places we could go. But Mark chapter 6, verse 30. So this is, he's sent them out. John the Baptist has been murdered. And there in verse 30, so there's a lot happening here. If you think about this, there's a lot of pretty tough stuff that they've gone through just in a very, very short period of time. "Then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, 'Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest for a while.'" And I'm going to stop there. I didn't mean to read verse 31 yet. So here Jesus has sent them out. And we know that Herod had killed John the Baptist. And then we have this verse 30 where we kind of get this glimpse into the apostles gathering around Jesus and telling him, hey, here's some, almost reporting to him, here's some of the things that's happened. And what they had been doing, what they had been teaching, and why would they do that? Well, so he can sit there and further follow up. And A, I think he was genuinely interested, but he wanted to use this time to teach and to see what's going on. And of course, again, pretty tough thing that's happened following John the Baptist's death. So then in verse 31, he says, "Come aside yourselves to a deserted place and rest for a while. For there were many coming and going, and they didn't even have time to eat." So think about this time and what was going on with them. But he realizes maybe the stress of the time, they realize what was happening, pulls them aside and says, "Hey, let's just go take a breather." I'm putting it in my words. Let's go out and get out of the mainstream, what's happening. You've got tons of people coming and going. You've done some work. And now let's take a step back. Any comments about supervision? There's a lot of things we could go read, but again, I'm just trying to hit the high points of these methods.
It's a good lesson for us. We all need to take time out.
Yep.
Your game's not going good.
That's a good point. Yeah. And clearly, there was a lot happening here, and a very important person had been murdered, and I think he realized that, hey, this is the time we need to recharge our batteries. And we've talked about how we only just see a glimpse here. Not everything's recorded, but I have a feeling there was a lot of encouragement going on at this time and taking the time to just back up just a little bit and make certain that we're all still on the same page. We're all okay. I'm still in charge, but we'll be fine. Yeah.
Exodus 18.
Okay.
With Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes to visit Moses, and it tells about all the things Moses was doing Verse 13, the next day Moses took a seat to serve as judge for the people. They stood around him from morning till evening. Basically, his father-in-law is like, what are you doing? Spending your whole day doing this. Why don't you divide up the work? And so in 24, Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from Israel and made them leaders of the people. Officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, they served as judges. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. So it reminded me that in the church, it's been established that we have a plurality of leadership as well, so that no one person, such as Moses or even Jesus, is stuck with everything. And there are many reasons for that. I think what you explained here.
Great. Yeah, great example of delegation. Yeah, very good. Good. Yep, thanks for that example. It goes along very well, doesn't it? And I'm just going to wrap that piece up, but I believe that, you know, he was giving them time and attention, just no different than he was early on. I think the crowds, you know, as the crowds were getting bigger and bigger and they were pushing in, and it was almost preventing them from doing some of the things they wanted to do. Think about the, if you will, the on-the-job training that they were receiving. You know, there was a lot happening there, but they were, if you will, on the job, getting to see first and foremost what to do. But you get the feeling, though, that he never lost sight of giving them guidance, giving them some coaching, helping them through this tough time. Okay, the last one, the last method that I had down, and I said that there's probably many methods. There's probably a lot of things that I'm missing. But I call it reproduction or replication of efforts, if you will. But it is very evident that he intended for them to become, and I told you I was going to make up a word, but disciplers. He was wanting them to make disciples of others. And, you know, the church is like the mustard seed. It starts out small, and yet we see it grow bigger and bigger. We think about the some verses that we read. What kind of fruit does an apple tree bear? What kind of fruit does a peach tree bear? What kind of fruit should a disciple bear? And I think, you know, the point here is that if they wanted his disciples to make other followers, what do you expect? And what do we expect? No different than what we expect from our kids, but what do we expect? What is expected of us as being good disciples, and that is that we can further make other disciples, more disciples. You know, I think the New Testament reveals these principles. It was a pattern for them in the early church. It's a pattern for us today. So I think it's really important. But we find Paul using them in his missionary work. He was residing in a city just long enough to reproduce leadership and to establish leaders, and then returning periodically. So we saw that over and over again. He encourages Timothy to make, if you will, disciplers. And then in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "And the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable men, who will also be qualified to each other." Perfect example of, you know, the things that we've taught, the things that I've heard, the things that I watched Jesus do, I'm handing to you, and I want you to do the exact same thing. It's no mistake that some of those very same words that we saw the apostles use with each other, those were the exact same things we heard Jesus say and do. But that pattern we see is carried forward. And it always has. And I just jotted down a few, and I'm sure you can think of some. There was Apollos, discipled by Aquila and Priscilla. You've got Barnabas, or Paul. There was Mark, whom Paul had, we could say, given up on, but Peter had succeeded with him. And then we've got Titus and Luke. There was many others there in the New Testament. But those are some of the specific examples of people that we could look to this program or this method, if you will, and say, hey, it worked. It did what it was supposed to do. So I'll pause there. Does anybody have any further comments or questions or any examples they want to use?
Teaching others is the best way to internalize information, actually. So
it's good.
If you're able to teach someone something that you've learned,
you'll really know it. You know it, yeah. Yep, you've become an expert. And it seems like you can tuck that away a lot better. I know there's, it seems like for those of us who have either led a downstairs class or led a class period, those things in which you turn around and teach, you'll retain, So to your point, it's very, very good, very important for all of us. And you may not publicly teach. Maybe you're not doing what I'm getting to do today. Maybe you don't go downstairs and teach. Maybe you have your own kids. Maybe you have others that you're ministering to. Maybe coworkers. Maybe your spouse. But taking the time to teach and pass that on is really important. And we have that example on large scale, and we have it in very private, small scale examples. We can read them over and over. We could take a whole class period to do that. And we know, and we talked about this, but Christ being the perfect teacher, being the perfect leader, taking imperfect people and doing a good job instilling those values and leadership qualities and teaching qualities with them. So, we've got stories of Moses, we've got stories of Joseph, we've got Nehemiah, who we recently studied. I mean, there's a lot of good examples. Paul, who went out and organized many of churches, but you take seemingly just everyday normal people, and look what that system was able to create.
So isn't it awesome? What a perfect teacher we have, and that carries right over to today, to us individually or as a church.
Yeah.
So we need to stay near him, because if we start moving away from him, it starts getting imperfect.
Yeah.
Fast,
yep.
Because we're all imperfect. But by sticking with his teaching and following him close as we can, that pattern will work all the way through.
Yeah. And I think there's another point to bring out. Just as those leaders or those disciples made mistakes, there was a lot of key learnings along the way, a lot of things that they maybe did that they look back and go, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or things that they had done that I'm sure Christ would pull them aside and show them or teach them and talk about. No different than us today. And I think that it's always easy to point fingers and ridicule or look at a leader and say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. But it's a good reminder for those who haven't maybe been in that leadership role or are in that leadership role, there's going to be mistakes made. And as leaders, we've got to be able to not be too proud to learn from those things. But those who are following also have to realize that, hey, it's a tough gig sometimes, and we've got to be willing to support and realize that, it's not going to always be perfect. Jesus was the only one that was going to be perfect in that scenario. So we should encourage those leaders. We should be there to support, help them be successful. So that brings us to Matthew chapter 17, which records the transfiguration where Jesus took Peter, James, and John up on the mountain. He joined them with Moses and Elijah to reveal, the divinity of Jesus. And you think about those three great leaders that Jesus had been teaching, who God, I guess you pre-authorize, if you will, everything that Jesus was about to do. There in Matthew chapter 18, which is the very next chapter, he begins with the example of the little child. We spoke of the little child that Jesus used as an object lesson to make the point of having the proper attitude. You think about that, those chapters and that chapter right there about the proper attitude. Mark chapter 9, we can go there for a little bit more insight. But Mark chapter 9, verses 33 through 37. Then he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it that you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. And he sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and set him up in the midst of them. And when he had spoken to him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." You know, you get this picture. All of us have, and this happens a lot, but all of us who are parents, if you've got a couple kids, they have these moments that you have to pull them aside and have these lessons with them. And here you see this exact same thing happening. "Hey, what was it you guys were talking about? What was that big dispute you're having on the road?" He starts with a fairly innocent question, says, "Okay, come on in, let's talk about this. Seriously, you think you're going to be the best? Well, guess what?" And so he uses this lesson to teach them. And he takes the opportunity, which I think is another great point for us as parents, great point for us as leaders and teachers, that sometimes in the moment is the best opportunity, not hours later, not the next day, but right then when it's happening. Take the time to pull them aside and talk about the teaching moment. And then he was going to teach them of the Good Samaritan prayer. There was a lot of different things that he was going to talk to them about. How to relate to Jews, how to relate to each other, how to deal with false teachers, how to deal with those who stray from the obedience, dealing with those that you've either offended or who have been offended, how to relate to jealous believers, how to deal with new converts and disciples. I mean, the list goes on and on of what he packed in some of these lessons. So, and then I was going to use at this time to talk about the parables that we talked about on Sunday night. So all of these things, these object lessons that he was preparing to teach, he used this very unique system for teaching it. He used these parables to something they could relate to. Those who were wanting the truth could get it. We, for those who are visiting today, and we appreciate you being here, we kind of broke away on Sunday night and just took the time to talk about parables and all the parables that are in the Bible and how those were used. And so we won't belabor the point. I will just ask real quick, though, what was one of the goals of using parables? Or maybe in using parables, what happened?
Well, it's giving taking a physical story,
yeah,
and teaching a spiritual lesson.
Okay. And why were they so difficult? I mean, why couldn't he have just spoke more plainly? We talked a little bit about this. He used those opportunities for those who are truly, diligently seeking him, that really wanted the truth, they would find it. Was it that much of a mystery to those people that wanted it? No. However, it was, you could almost say on the flip side, it was concealment of the truth. For those who didn't want to know and thought it was silly, they wouldn't understand it. They didn't get it. And then we talked about kind of a third goal is, parables would elicit the truth from those that may otherwise be reluctant to acknowledge it. Those who might be reluctant or might typically not be interested, it was something that would maybe elicit that inside of them. So those were some of the points we talked about, which brings us to then the Sermon on the Mount. And we'll probably just get started a little bit with that. But if I was to ask you today, very short order, the Sermon on the Mount, of course, we know is recorded in Matthew chapters 5-7. What would be your answer as to what the Sermon on the Mount was about? There's a lot of things, but in general,
I believe it was the beginning of him trying to help the people convert over from the old law to the new law.
Okay, so helping make that
transition.
Okay, for sure that was part of it, that physical conversion. What else might you say? There's no wrong answer, well, there may be, but if you were to give a highlight of what the Sermon on the Mount was, how about citizenship of the God's kingdom? And I'm sure there's many answers here, but how do you become a citizen of God's kingdom? And, you know, I was thinking about this citizenship, if you will, so just bear with me for a minute here. When someone comes to America from another country and they want to become a citizen of the United States, what's the first thing they've got to do? What's one of the first things you're going to have to do?
Apply.
Okay, you're going to have to apply, but before I'm probably even thinking about applying, I've got to go do what? I've got to go learn some things. So I'm going to have to learn some things about our country. And there's an application process in there. But at some point in time, I'm going to promise to obey. Because I can't just come in this country and do whatever I want to do. I'm going to say, yep, I promise to obey your laws and rules. I promise to be loyal to the government. And so I was thinking about this citizenship thing. But it's no different than if we want to be part of God's kingdom. The same is true. If I want to be part of God's kingdom, what do I have to do? I'm going to have to go learn about the kingdom. I'm going to have to go understand this kingdom. And I need to know what Jesus is all about. And if I'm going to be part of His kingdom and I want to be a citizen, then there are certain things that are asked of us. So I've got to learn those things. I'm going to have to say I would want to obey those things. And to me, that's what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. Is those types of things. So let's just turn to Matthew chapter 5. We'll spend a little time here. Matthew chapter 5. And I'm going to go ahead and read the Beatitudes. So we'll read there through verses 1 through 12. And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. And so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So the Beatitudes, and I've got it B-E-B, attitudes. Having the right attitude is, when I think of these Beatitudes, I think of having the right attitude. You know, there's, I guess you could say there's the code of ethics, which is just your standard conduct. I think we read about how there's contrast here of the kingdom versus worldly or external or temporal things. There's the contrast of superficial faith, if you will, like the Pharisees, with real faith. And then the Old Testament expectations will be fulfilled in the new kingdom. And I think when we read through those Beatitudes, those are some of the things that we get. And before I kind of get out of the Beatitudes, and I'm not spending a ton of time here, but anybody have any thoughts or just quick comments about that, about that section, if you will? It's pretty straightforward. I know we've studied a lot about it. I know a lot of our kids' classes have been about it. Then if we get into verses 14 through 16, I'm just trying to not get bogged down in these verses because we could spend days reading them. But I believe this is showing the way to others. And I'll back up and read 13. "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be overthrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." I'll go through 16. "Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in this house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." How much does having the right attitude have to do with drawing others to the gospel? And I'm just going to pause there because I really am looking for answers. Do you think having the proper attitude or the right attitude is important? And if so, how important? Can you have an okay attitude and draw people in? It's difficult. I think about anything, whether it's someone selling a product or something that you are maybe interested in. Have you ever gone to buy something and it's maybe a pretty significant purchase and you're excited? You think this is exactly what you want and the person you're buying from is not that excited about it. They maybe tell you one thing and you're like, oh no. And all of a sudden you're like, but I really wanted this. And then all of a sudden you don't. Have you ever went to buy a car and you thought that's the car you wanted, and then you did your homework, or the person that was selling it to you was just not very energetic about it, or maybe they... What ended up happening? I know, for me, I didn't end up with that vehicle. So I think our attitude, when it comes to having a good attitude or trying to draw others in, is unbelievably important. And, you know, I think the thing that can be difficult as Christians is that, you know, having a good attitude 24/7 is not always easy. But it doesn't take long for someone to see that our attitude maybe has highs and lows to it before they think, why would I be drawn to that? I mean, what's so significant about this person you call Christ and you're following him and this is how you act? One minute things are great, the next minute you're angry or mad. The next minute you're super negative or you're whatever. So I think to me this showing others the way and this light that's talked about here, they put it on a lampstand, they don't put it under a basket. I mean, we teach this at a very, very elementary level to our kids about letting your light shine. And, you know, this letting your light shine, I think, is so, so very important that at all times, regardless of the setting, people can see your good works. Guess what? The outside world typically is not exposed to what we do in here. So some might be able to come and fool people and have these great works and be helpful and super nice on the 2 hours that we're going to be here today and maybe on Wednesday or maybe tonight. But no one else gets to see that. What they do is they get to see you in your work setting. They get to see you possibly at your very worst. I'll just give you an interesting story. We have a teacher at school that I happen to, from the interactions I see, I thought a lot of. I thought she was really, really good. She seemed super energetic. Every time I've been around her and I won't elaborate, but every interaction that she has with the kids, and she has these various things that she'll put on with the kids, she seems awesome. And Kinsey came home the other day and was like, you will not believe what happened in class the other day. And Kinsey hardly ever talks about school, about what happens, maybe because she knows that I like to go follow up on things, so she's probably scared. But she said, so-and-so screamed at the top of their lungs and they threw their cell phone across the room. And anyway, and she went on with this story, and I had to clarify. I said, do what? And she went on to say that she was yelling at this person. It's because they weren't responding, and they yelled to the point where this kid cried, and then she threw herself on. And I was just thinking about how that tainted my view of this teacher, who I thought was just really, really good. I thought she was awesome. I had seen her in various settings, and I thought she was really good. But that one story, and you know, I asked Kinsey, I'm like, well, does that happen very often? She's like, well, actually, every couple of weeks, she gets really mad. And I'm thinking, wow, but... That's the point. Our attitude has to be on point consistently at all times. That means that we're not going to have, inopportune things happen and that we might make mistakes and we need to, fix that and show maybe whoever we had that mistake in front of that we're willing to ask for forgiveness. We know we're going to have that opportunity. But I'm saying that consistency is the name of the game for us. And as one who is following Christ, we should be able to be in total control. We should be able to exude the qualities that he has passed on to us, in a very consistent way. So I'm going to pause there for a minute. Any thoughts or comments about that? Okay. Hard to convince people when we aren't willing to do what we're saying should be done, right? Hard to convince our kids that X, Y, or Z needs to be done when you every once in a while break X, Y, or Z. So Our demeanor, showing others the way, having that proper attitude is oh so important. Continue on in Matthew chapter 5, we skip down to verses 21 through 22. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. This word danger here, and I'm going to call it having the right heart, because as we look through various verses, and I'll just skip down before I make my comments. Verse 27, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And then skipping down, verse 31, 32. Furthermore, has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And that whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Can a person obey God without having the right heart? Is that even possible? What is important in our heart? You know, I was thinking about this going back up here about the murder and being angry, and the verbiage that's used there, in danger of hell, in danger of losing your soul. You know, when we become angry and our heart is not right, there's danger there. There's danger in all of these things, and I just read a few verses that puts us in danger of losing our soul. I don't know what else to really say about those things other than we have to keep ourselves in check to know that there's going to be consequences to all of our decisions. Whether just out of anger, we in a moment of rage we seek out to kill, or in just being angry, we the example I just gave about the teacher. What kind of impression did she have then on all those kids that are sitting there? I know the impression that I now have just even hearing the story, and I wasn't there. But what kind of impression will that give off to those around them? Any comments about that as I ring the bell?
I make a quick point about Jesus. Jesus was angry at the time or two as well.
He was.
Jesus turned over some tables.
What caused that anger?
What we might call righteous anger.
Righteous.
There are times where some fairly strong anger can be appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to be in control of it, without question.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think his anger wasn't going to produce or bring forth murder. You know, and I think that's to your point. There's a difference there. You know, this angry here that was the warning of losing your soul basically is a total different anger. Yeah, you're right. In righteousness or being very disciplined.